Hello and welcome to Sunstone Symposium Session 361, entitled, Do You Have a Testimony Of? My name is John DeLynn. I'm your moderator. It's very exciting to have you all here. Quick reminder, please turn off your cell phones, blah, blah, blah. Hope you've been having a good time at the session so far. You know that we sell the MP3s of these sessions and others, both at the registration desk and online, so keep that in mind. This is a really important session for many of the people that I come in contact with within the church. I have a podcast that explores issues within Mormonism very openly and candidly. And a lot of times, frankly, a candid exploration of Mormon history or doctrine or culture often leads to some point of disaffection where someone loses their traditional testimony, that scaffolding falls apart, and then it leaves them to then try and figure out a way to rebuild their testimony in a way that allows them to still stay in the church. And we all know that temple attendance is an important component of the Latter-day Saint life in these times. And you could even argue that for a faithful Mormon, that would be an important component of maintaining and growing their faith. And so the question of this session really is, once you've radically restructured your testimony, even to the point of saying, what I mean by God is probably something very different than what my bishop thinks when he thinks of God. And what I think of the atonement and Jesus might be very different than what the bishop's thinking and the restoration. You know, if you have to reconstruct that, then when you go into the temple ceremony interview and you have to answer those questions, what are the ethics around sort of that topic? So that's sort of what we're here to talk about today. Our presenters are first Tom Kimball. He's the marketing director for Signature Books, or Cohort Press, as he likes to call it. He's the book review editor for the Journal of Mormon History. I'm just totally kidding. He's the co-author of For Better or Worse, For Apostasy, How Faith Issues Affect Couple Relationships, and he's a very dear friend of mine, Tom Kimball. James McLaughlin is a professor of philosophy at Western Carolina University. He's a first place winner in the 2007 R.L. Buzz Capener Memorial Writing Contest in Comparative Religious Studies. And he was the first person that I ever moderated or spoke at a panel for in Sunstone 2 years ago. And he's wearing the same hat that he did then, or at least a derivation thereof.
Is it the same?
It's not a hat. So these guys have a lot that they want to say to other. My job is to try to each other. My job is to try and represent the rest of you and make sure that it's not just a conversation between them, but that what they say actually maybe is interesting and important to the rest of us as well. So it's a tall order. But let's begin by having each of you guys tell us a little bit about yourselves, starting with Tom.
Test.
It's taped now. It only goes that far.
Test.
Let's switch.
Does that one work?
If I talk really loud into it, it will.
So you just have to hold it right up to your mouth.
A man stands holding a baby. He's about to become the child's godfather. A Catholic priest pours water over the child's forehead and asks the man, "Do you believe in the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth?" The man responds, "I do." "Do you believe in Jesus Christ, the only Son, our Lord?" "I do." "Do you believe in the Holy Ghost and the Holy Catholic Church?" "I do." "Michael Corleone, do you renounce Satan?" "I do." Jim and I have been friends for some time now. I've always been interested in Sunstone presentations, and I thank you for having a conversation with me. Some years back, my spouse and I were forced with several religious dilemmas. I don't know that we were mature enough then or even now to make a competent and simple and intelligent decision. Though Paige and I have not made exactly the same decision, I have chosen to remain LDS.
Thank you.
An attempt to participate fully as my conscience allows in my LDS services. I currently sing in the ward choir. I run an 11-year-old scouting program. I teach elders quorum lessons and attend church. Though I'm not outwardly fully orthodox in my behavior, my hair, or my thinking, I recently purchased a white shirt. And I even wear a tie to church. But one great hurdle presents itself that keeps me from being fully integrated member of the church and holding a temple recommend. We are often told as Latter-day Saints to go to the temple and find spiritual answers, but it's the interview questions that keep me from this sacred place. I've had this discussion with several friends and confidants, many of whom share my doubts and dilemmas, but many of them, like you, hold current temple recommends. I sense that on some level you and they have to be deceptive on some level in order to have a recommend. I empathize with those with people whose employment, their marriages, their family status depends on holding a recommend. I grant that the current system encourages deception, but I will have nothing to do with it. In my fantasy LDS church, there has to be room in the temple for some doubters who simply want to spend time in our sacred space and attend their children's marriages. I desperately long to escort my sons through their endowments, just as my father did when I received mine. Must I betray my conscience to do so?
You know, we've gone talked about this for a while, and I knew he was going to use the Michael Corleone quote, but I never really realized it until just now it was about me. Anyway, Tom and I got into this conversation. Well, we've talked for a long time, but we got into this conversation last November in Washington, D.C. at the American Academy of Religion meeting. And that's when we decided to do this. And we both come at it from slightly different backgrounds. Tom describes his youth as becoming a fervent Mormon. For me, I was in a fairly fervent Mormon family, but I had severe doubts about the church all the way up through my mission. In fact, the immediate cause of me going on my mission, there were other, if those of you who grew up in Salt Lake know that everybody expects you to do it. But the immediate cause was my dad was the sweetest man in the world. And one day we were talking about it, and he looked at me and he said, "You know, you don't have to go."
You were dead.
I knew I was going. and so you struggle with these things. I'm not a person that has had a lot of spiritual experiences in my life, if you think of spiritual experiences in the way they're usually described. Although I would describe that experience with my father as being one of the great spiritual experiences of my life. But recently my father died, about 6 months ago, and he died in the arms of my sister. And one of the last things he said to her was, "Don't doubt." And she said, it's interesting, I'm 52 now, and when she told me that over the phone, I realized for the first time in my life, I really didn't doubt anymore. The question, of course, was, what is it you don't doubt? And that's what we're going to talk about.
So, Tom, tell us a bit about why you're having this conversation.
Okay. As I've been talking to my friends who are doubters, who have gone through the crisis of faith, but who have remained active Latter-day Saints, you know, some of them still hold recommends, and some of them don't. And in asking them why they can justify holding a temple recommend, when I know that they have many of the same concerns that I have myself, I feel as if it's like Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof. One of the future son-in-laws asked Tevye if he can have if he can marry the daughter. And if you remember in the film, time stops. And Tevye thinks to himself, on this hand, there's this question. On this hand, there's this answer. On this hand, there's this. And there's this hand, there's this. And then time turns back on, and he says, yes. Well, I feel that's what my buddies are doing. When the bishop asks, do you believe in God, the Eternal Father, and the Son, Jesus Christ, and the Holy Ghost? Time stops. And they debate this thing in their head, back and forth, right hand, left hand, on this hand, there's this hand. Time starts, and the answer is yes. But it's not to the question that was asked, it's to their debate. And so, you know, I have a concern that's what's going on, as opposed to answering a real yes or no question.
Okay, yeah. 15 years ago, yeah, that happened. I sit there with the bishop, and there were a few years in there that I didn't have a temple recommend. But then there came to be a point where, you know, and I'd read this passage many years before. You know, it's the one in the teachings of the prophet Joseph Smith, where Joseph talks about not having any creeds. You know, creeds are nice things, but they set up a signpost and say, "This, past this you cannot go." And then he says, but I want to enter directly into the presence of God. So, you know, I figured after a while, it didn't matter what my bishop thinks. I'm Orthodox. I know I'm Orthodox. So I don't have the moment anymore where I go this and that. Although, we talked about this before, too. Remember, Tevye goes this and that, through the first two daughters. But then he gets to the final daughter who's going to marry the Gentile, the Russian soldier. And he says, on the other hand, but there is no other hand. So yeah, sooner or later you have to get to a point where you can't go this or that. Where you have to say, no, this is it. This is what I, you know, as Luther says, here I stand, I can do no other. We just think that points in different places.
Okay. So let's start talking a little bit about specifics. Let's talk about I think is the first question. You know, do you have a testimony of God the Father, His Son Jesus Christ, and the Holy Ghost? Tom, tell us your conflicts over that question.
I interviewed my elders' quorum president in preparation for this discussion. I didn't want to interview the bishop because I was going to baptize my kid shortly, and I didn't want to create a big roller coaster conversation. But so I interviewed the next step down for me, and I sat him in my living room, and I posed this question to him, and I said, "There seems to me to be four ways in which you can view God and Jesus and the Holy Ghost. And the first way, or four general views in which a person can view these things. One is that the person has always believed, they've had spiritual experiences to confirm it, and they have no reason to doubt their belief. The second one is that they believe, but they have no real reason to doubt, and it's just tradition. But you know, it's just something that's there. The third tier down, I think is where I'm at, is where I have significant doubts in the existence of God. But I don't hope for the existence of God or for the non-existence of God. I wish God was there, and I have great hope that God can be meaningful to me, in spite of my the fact that I can't actually conceive that he exists. And the next tier down is, I guess, would be the person who doesn't believe in God, doesn't want to believe in God, is a missionary for atheism, and so on and so forth. There's a spectrum of belief. Where in this spectrum would my elders' quorum president draw the line as far as being able to say yes to that question? And I expected it to be pretty close to the first two. Surprisingly, he said, if I have hope for God, that I should say yes to that question, which was surprising to me.
But before we hear Jim's response, Tom, I'd like to ask you your opinion, then I'd like to poll the audience. And this audience won't be representative of Mormonism broadly. Maybe.
Really?
Maybe it's slightly skewed.
Slightly skewed.
So what is your opinion of the percentage breakdown of each of those four categories among members of the church? And I'm particularly interested in category three. But tell me your answer. Where do you think the average active member of the church falls in those four categories?
Would the question better be the average temple recommend holder?
No, the average active member.
The average active member would fall in the first two categories.
No, but like, give me a percentage for each.
30%? 70, 80, 90% in the first two categories.
The first two categories, in your opinion?
Yeah.
And then the third category is what?
That would be us here.
So 20%, okay.
5, 10, 20%, something like that.
And there's 2% of the guys that just get temple recommends so they can go and...
Okay.
Being the, they got
to vote. Let's do a vote. Who puts themselves in the first category? Raise your hand. First category, Tom.
Absolutely believe in God. Have had spiritual experiences to justify it. And they've never had any reason not to doubt the existence of God.
Raise your hand higher. Raise your hand. Okay. Second category
would be someone who has never really had any spiritual experiences, but has never had any reason to doubt that God exists.
Second category, raise your hand. Okay. Third category is?
Someone who doubts the existence of God, but has a hope that there's something meaningful there, and has a hope that maybe someday they could find something of value within the concept of God.
Who's in that category? Raise your hand. Okay, and the fourth, complete doubters of God.
Complete atheists.
Raise your hand. Okay. All right. I'm wondering whether
Sorry
more
about
members
that.
Than I'm wondering whether if you had a one-on-one conversation with members, active members of the church, whether you'd find more in category three than you would think, although they wouldn't profess this openly in Sunday school. But Jim, go ahead and respond.
Okay. I don't know if you noticed, but I raised my hand for all four. Because I'm a philosopher. And I think it's very important to think about what you mean by all four answers. He's shaking his head. Michael Corleone. Okay. But let me explain what I mean. Since we're moderns, we live post-Descartes, and since Descartes, the primary function the idea of knowledge in the West has been epistemological certainty. There was a great English don, I got his name down here, G.E. Moore, okay, who once listed all the things I can know with certainty. They were incredibly boring. Okay. Something like, I'm having experience. Yeah. Okay. Okay, well, but, William James once wrote about his essay, The Will to Believe, that this is not the way we live our lives. Oops, sorry. Okay. Just for the second. Okay. This is not the way we live our lives. Nobody lives their life that way. We have to make choices. We have to make decisions. We have to commit ourselves to things. Kierkegaard has this great definition of truth that really sounds like gobbledygook. That truth is an objective uncertainty held fast in an appropriation process of the most passionate inwardness. Right, go tell your friends. But what he means by that is I have to bring myself to it. It's not like 2 plus 2 equals 4. I have no freedom to decide whether that's true there. When I met my wife, I had a decision to make, whether I would pursue this or not, whether I would make it true. In that sense, I think, yes, we can answer truthfully to all four of those questions. I think there is a minimum that we perhaps don't doubt. I love my wife. I believe that I see Christ in the face of most people I run into. Should be all people. I'm not that good. But the transcendent deity of all the stories, I hope for that. And the way some people talk about the transcendent deity, I'd rather be an atheist.
So Tom, what's wrong with that? I mean, the Book of Mormon, if you read Alma 32, it describes faith as a hope. And it doesn't say, do you have a firm conviction that God the Father is an anthropomorphic being and resides, on Kolob?
It says, do you have a testimony of God? And faith is defined in the Book of Mormon as a hope. So why is that bar not acceptable? Just, I hope he's there. Why isn't that good enough to get you in the temple?
Oh, I'm not saying that it isn't good enough.
Why is it an ethical dilemma for someone to even be in that position?
Well, let's come down to the next part of the question, and Jesus Christ.
Okay.
As I interviewed my eldest quorum president, I asked, he said with regards to God, hope is good enough. But when it came to Jesus Christ, there was the discussion of, okay, whether or not, I laid out the same four things, but there were issues of, Jesus was real. He walked on water. He raised the dead. He was resurrected. He's raised from the dead, and he died on the cross for us. And then we came down a few tiers. Maybe he was real, but he didn't walk on water. Some of the stories are exaggerated. Okay, and then the next tier down, with regards to my eldest quorum president, was that the atonement and the resurrection were metaphors, and that he stopped and said that in order to say yes for him, you had to believe in the reality of the atonement and the reality of the resurrection. And that to me, maybe that's a lapse in logic and so forth on his behalf, but that wasn't an issue of hope. That was an issue of you had to believe those two things in order to answer those questions.
Well, just on the pure historicity of Jesus, what's wrong with putting Jesus in the same category as God and just saying, you know what, I hope there was a Jesus who lived. There's a fuzzy history.
That,
if we really hold the scrutiny to Jesus, just like we might the Bible or the Book
right.
of Mormon, the evidence doesn't seem to add up. But what's wrong with just putting Jesus in that category, broadly defining atonement, not using the weights and balances, every sin ever committed, with all the blood that was spilt in the Garden of Gethsemane.
I'm with you. But that's not the point.
That too.
I'm with you. No, I didn't say that. I just said, you may be there. I'm not. But with regards to my eldest quorum president, the answer is I had to believe in the reality of the atonement and the reality of the resurrection. Period.
Okay.
Literal.
This is the on the other hand, sooner or later you get to something you have to say, yeah. But let me just say something about this. God, let me go back to God the Father for just a second, and just find what I mean by a minimum and a maximum here. A minimum would be, Matthew 25. Even if you've done it under the least of these, my brethren, you've done it under me. One of the most profound spiritual experience I had on my mission was reading the King Follett Discourse. Nobody came down, no angels, nothing like that. But the idea that God was a human being. I sat down with a Marxist friend of mine who worked for the SNCF, the railroad, and he asked me if I believed in God, and I looked at him, and he was such a great guy. Of course I believed in God. He was it. Because what we got here in Mormonism that's so incredibly wonderful, and this is what I don't doubt, is that we look at other human beings as being divine. Whether they're, you say God's an embryo or whatever you say, you look at them as being divine. If you really were to look at them as being divine, you'd be nicer to them. And that's something you shouldn't doubt. The resurrection works that way for me, too. I've read Kwasan, I've read Ehrman, and I have all sorts of doubts about the historicity of certain claims that are made in the New Testament. And yet, when Dostoevsky came out of that prison camp in Siberia and came back to Russia, he wrote to a Russian woman that he knew, and he said, if I had to choose between truth and Christ, I would choose Christ. Now, what did he mean by that? It doesn't mean he's a fundamentalist. What he means is he regarded Christ as the ideal human being in the flesh. That's his words. And what I mean is that, a lot of people in this world have had really shitty lives. So we have to hope for a resurrection. You just should. Because it's a better way to look at the world. I remember Sterling McMurrin once quoting F.H. Bradley saying, yes, the universe may be a cold, empty place, but to say that and like it, you'd have to be crazy.
Tom, quick response, or if you have one.
Well, according to our script here, Jim was supposed to go on a post-modernistic rant. I accuse him of doing so, and then he's supposed to apologize.
So, apology, please.
We're ad-libbing this, so I'm not going to.
Okay, I'm going to give a bit of a setup and an introduction to this next question that, Tom, I didn't tell you I'd do.
Okay.
What about the argument that the entire process of the Temple Recommend interview has been intentionally set up to allow for a broad tent? What I mean by that is the following. The questions, in many instances, could easily be interpreted as being very vague and open.
You're picking Jim's side.
No. I'm giving you a softball, Tom. Okay, this is your softball.
He's gonna serve it up to you.
This is your softball. I'm gonna take a long time so you can hit out of the park and think of your answer. Okay, so vague questions. Ecclesiastical leaders are specifically told and even censured if they add to the questions that are there. They're told not to add to the questions, and the person being interviewed is allowed to be the one who decides yes or no. They don't ask for your W-2s when they ask about tithing. They don't say, is this an anthropomorphic God or a historical Jesus? It's very much up to you to decide. Now, they could have had a list of 200 questions, and they could have given the bishop and the stake president the ability to add more and to go into lots of detail. But instead, I had a stake president once who said to me, have you had this interview before? Yes. Do you remember the questions that you were asked? Yes. Would you answer the same way in the affirmative that you had in the past? Yes. Okay, let me sign your recommend. So there's the softball, Tom. You know, this is about, is it unethical if you know that what you mean by your question is different than what the ecclesiastical leader is likely to be thinking or believing, with the also acknowledgement that depending on what bishop or stake president you ask, you might even get different responses. So knowing that it's just that soft and that big tent, where's the dilemma?
Let me set this up just a little bit. In the process, a few years back, of getting permission to baptize my middle son, the bishop withheld that ability, and the first thing he asked me was, he wanted me to have temple recommend in order to do it, first of all. And when I bowed, I said, I don't want a temple recommend right now, I'm trying to work through some things. He said, well, I need to get someone else to baptize my kid. Okay, that's not fair. It's my kid. I'm active. Okay. I found that in the process of the interview, he wanted me to tell him what my doubts were. I'm a 13-year veteran in the book trade. I'm the book review editor for the Journal of Mormon History. I was Kurt Bench's rare book buyer. Okay, I'm Simon Southerton's, Todd Compton's, Dan Vogel's, Mike Quinn's. I'm their publicist. Okay. How in the world is he going to be able to have anything, be able to handle anything I unload on him? Okay? I felt like I had to be the adult in the conversation.
Those of you with Temple Recommends, can you put his bishop's name in the box for name in at the temple?
In the temple, yeah.
He needs help.
No, he doesn't. He's a good guy. And to answer your question, what I'm saying is that with regards to my issue is that my bishop is asking me an orthodox question. I know what the orthodox answer is. And I know that if I take the orthodox answer the question that he's asking me, I know that the answer, if you don't do the philosophical fancy dance, the answer is no to some of them for you.
Okay.
We're friends.
Yeah, we really are. Now, anyway. Give us 20 minutes. The Book of Mormon. You open up first page. It talks about all the mistakes of men. B.H. Roberts, in the Comprehensive History of the Church talks about people carrying sacred things in earthen vessels, go back to the Book of Mormon. Mormon talks about there being mistakes in the Book of Mormon. We Mormons always quote the Article of Faith that says the Bible, you know, as far as it is translated correctly. There was an old Pat Bagley cartoon where the kid looks at his dad and says, "Yes, I believe in you as far as you are translated correctly." But actually, that's the situation. Anything that comes, I think God's a human being. It's imperfect. We work through it. We struggle along. I am not going to give my bishop's a wonderful guy. I really like him. But I think he's wrong about a lot of stuff. I'm going to let him decide whether I'm Orthodox or not. I know I'm Orthodox. When he asks the question, I say yes. If he has another opinion, that's his problem. And he never asked me to explain what I mean by Orthodox. Most of the folks in my ward know what I mean. But, you know, it's kind of like, you remember Sam Taylor? I remember sitting in Sunstone listening to Sam Taylor, and somebody got up, you know, he was talking about a trip he did to the temple and, you know, needed a cup of coffee. On the you know this one? And he said, somebody, "How do you have a temple recommend?" And Sam Taylor said, "I've been blessed with liberal bishops."
Okay, Jim, I want to push back a little bit, because I think I've discovered some limits in that logic of thinking. Okay. And I'll give you a hypothetical. Let's say that you don't feel comfortable giving 10% of your income to the church, but you're comfortable giving 5% of your income to the church and 5% of your income to other charitable organizations that you believe God would be happy with, and that in your mind that represents 10% of your income to God as tithing. You know, in that instance, are you comfortable because you feel comfortable that that's an Orthodox position? Is that ethical then to say that you're a full tithe payer?
I think it's the church's position. I remember when I was at BYU, I actually taught there for a while. We had this conversation in the philosophy department, and Truman Madsen said the church had asked him to look into this, and what he came back with was, "That's between you and God, what your tithing is." I think you should pay 10% of, you should give 10% of your money to somebody besides yourself.
But Jim,
you should give all of it.
But if you redefine the law of chastity to mean what you want it to mean, and if you redefine, what else? Word of wisdom to be what you want it to mean, then all of a sudden,
I don't.
Yeah, what he said.
What he said.
You've really sort of bastardized the
I agree with what you're saying here. I think it's this is whenever you start thinking about things, it's dangerous. but I think on that particular issue on tithing, I think that is the church's position. Because people get up in my ward and they say it's before taxes. The other people get up and say, "No, it isn't." They're a little quieter. and say it's after taxes. Yeah, I don't say anything. So.
No, but okay. All right.
Okay, I recognize the difficulty of what you're saying. Because, you could redefine everything.
But you're saying it's between you and God.
But you got,
if you feel good about it, it's okay.
And that's why, I really appreciate what Tom did here for me, because one of the reasons I am highly suspect of religious experience is, and even I think they're great things. I think people should have them. Section 46 of the Doctrine and Covenants, it talks about people having gifts, and then some people don't have those gifts. Okay? But one of the things I'm suspect about is that, have you ever noticed this, that people seem to think that God thinks the way they do? It's remarkable. The coincidence there. But if you do like Mormons do, if you think that the divine is in other people, they call you into question all the time. This is why Sartre said hell is other people. Because they call Tom making me do this. I was really comfortable until he asked me to do this. They call you into question. And what that question calls me into question. And so you really have to take it seriously and you really have to think about it. and you have to struggle with it. You know, on the other hand, you can do just what you were saying. You know, I'm in love with her. Of course, it's chaste. I'll take her as a second wife.
Okay. All right. Let's move on to the question about the restoration. Tom, do you have any thoughts about the difficulties around the restoration question?
Well, I have a couple questions for Jim with regards to the restoration. My question is, what is the restoration? Is it the restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ, or is the restoration with regards to that they're asking us, is it Joseph Smith's first vision? Is it the golden plates? Is it the angel Moroni? Is it Peter, James, and John, and so on and so forth? My dilemma is that I feel that the mechanism of the restoration is broken. There are problems with the first vision narrative. There are problems with the golden plates narrative. There are problems with regards to the historical narratives of the restoration that cannot be fixed. The Melchizedek priesthood, and, you know, the Peter, James, and John appearing, and so on and so forth. There are conflicts and contradictions with regards to the historical record, and yet I find aspects of the restoration to be very meaningful to me. The narrative of the pre-earth life with Satan presenting a plan that is we're all forced to be good, and Jesus presenting a plan wherein we would fail, and through the opposition of all things that we would find misery and holiness, and these narratives are very meaningful and powerful stories in my life. And yet the mechanism through which I got them is broken. And the question I have is, with that being the case, can I answer yes to that question?
You know, I wouldn't be here if I didn't think you could. But Tom's a much better historian than I am. I started out as a historian and switched to philosophy. It's probably easier being a philosopher because you don't have to deal with the real world often. But, you know, I was thinking about, in some of our original conversations, I was thinking about the question of the Holy Ghost and the restoration. For me, the Holy Spirit, at a minimum level, what I don't doubt, means that it's what unites us, what binds us together, what struggles with us, and in us and between us to make us better people. And it's what moves the gospel forward. And this can mean that there are a whole lot of people that are moving the gospel forward that are currently out of the church. But with the restoration, let me give you a quote, one of my favorite quotes here. Well, let me paraphrase it. Let me step back for just a minute. I've spent, not only the restoration, I mean, you know, I do religious studies. I do comparative religion. Everybody's story's messed up. Okay? I remember going back, and struggling through all the historical Jesus stuff and looking at the Book of Mormon stuff, reading the Farms guys, reading the other guys. And, you know, I couldn't make up my mind. I don't speak Hebrew. I don't read Greek. I don't have any archaeological knowledge. Nobody has all of it anyway. You know? And so I figured, you have to kind of take a stand somewhere. And one of my heroes is William H. Chamberlain. He's the first Mormon to study philosophy. He studied with George Holmes Howison at California and Josiah Royce, one of the great American philosophers. And those of you who know his story, it didn't end good. he taught at BYU for a while and got kicked out. But at BYU, he gave this wonderful speech. It was on Thanksgiving. And he was talking about being thankful for the attempt to build Zion here in the desert. And he said, what the pioneers did was beautiful. It was so beautiful. It was so wonderful. It's such a beautiful story. And then he went on and he said, even if the gospel weren't true, there is no reason we can't make it true. That's like a mantra for me. What I believe the restoration does is restores that idea that God is not distant. God is not an absolutely perfect being, no need of us. And this is the story that you buy, too, about the story of the council in heaven. These stories are terribly important. I don't know exactly what happened back in 1830. Something I don't completely understand, but I'm willing to take that shot that there's something here that's very, very important. And I think that's what the restoration is.
Well, we've run through the main set of questions other than is it okay to lie to the bishop?
That was an important one.
That was a question I was least crazy about asking. We've covered it some, but let's just give Tom and Jim, each of you, a chance to sort of either address that question or close with some thoughts to give us, within 6 minutes, 10 minutes, for some Q&A.
Okay. I have a dilemma. And it seems to me that within Mormonism there is a culture of deception, and it's a dilemma for me. It starts with Joseph Smith, and it starts with the first Mormon narrative. The first Mormon narrative is about Nephi. Nephi starts his statement by saying, I will go and do the things which the Lord hath commanded, for I know that the Lord will give no commandment to the children of man, save he shall prepare a way for him to accomplish that thing which he has commanded. Nephi had 10 commandments. Don't kill, don't lie, and don't steal. Those are 3 of them. And he was told to go and get the plates. And in order to get the plates, he broke 3 commandments. Joseph Smith lied about polygamy. Joseph F. Smith lied about post-manifesto polygamy. There is a culture of deception and lying within our community. And I feel that this is one of the ways that within the questions that are asked in the temple, that we encourage our doubting young men and women to learn deceptive acts in order to preserve employment, their marriages, their status within their community. And I think that there's something fundamentally wrong with this.
This was, when we were talking about this, this was the place where I'm supposed to apologize. And no, this was the hardest question. You go to somebody like Soren Kierkegaard, and he talks about a teleological suspension of the ethical, which is something I don't believe in. I don't think that you get to do that. That when Abraham sacrifices Isaac, this is supposed to be you're not supposed to kill your kids, but the way we usually tell that story, Abraham's prepared to give everything. What about the kid? Didn't he get to say anything? If you look at Jewish interpretations of that story, the important part is it comes at the end when Abraham is supposed to, kill him. And the angel says to him, don't touch the kid. And, in some Jewish interpretations, he's looking into Isaac and he sees he's not supposed to touch the kid. And so, I think there are incredibly disturbing things in our history, on this very question that Tom brings up, lying with the idea that somehow this is going to do good for the church, so it's ultimately good. And I think Tom's absolutely right, too, that we put a lot of pressure, social pressure, on people to say they believe things they don't believe. For years, I didn't believe I was a very spiritual person or a very good Mormon, because I found a lot of the things that I was told to believe incredible. I could not believe them. I still can't believe them. Some of them I hope for, like Mom and Dad are on Kolob, But that, I think, is what we have to struggle with. I think if we were more honest in letting people know what it is they have to believe, or what it is the minimum, perhaps. I remember there's a great quote from Brigham Young that I found, 10 years ago, that I wish I'd found 40 years ago, where he says, you only have to believe what's true. Now, if we could just do that, or if we could just accept the fact that you get in Section 46 of the Doctrine and Covenants, not everybody gets these gifts. Cut them some slack. Because that's what it says there. Don't throw them out of your midst. Let them, if they're willing to do the stuff, because after all, what's more important? Living the ethical life is what God calls us to. I got to say one more thing. I'm really going on a rant here. Postmodern rant.
You talk about genuine.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I forgot about that. Yeah, let me bring that up. Yeah, okay. I forgot about it. I'm sorry. He brought up the very important point of Nephi. That was always a disturbing thing. I remember hearing Gene England talk about this and saying, that line, Nephi being bored of goodly parents, blah, 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 and talking about suffering. What Gene said is his interpretation of that, and this may be far-fetched, but I thought it was cool, was that he is looking back at that moment that he still doubts. Did I do the right thing? Killing that guy. I think that's interesting. The other thing I think is really interesting about that is, remember what the Spirit tells Nephi? This has always bugged me that we don't talk about this more. Better that one man should die than a nation should dwindle and perish in unbelief. Do you remember where else that said? That's what Caiaphas says about Jesus. Better that one man should die. I mean, there's got to be a reason they use that line in there. Why don't we ever talk about it? This is a tough point. That's why we don't talk about it. Okay, but I think that's the thing that Kierkegaard says, and I don't agree with Kierkegaard on many things, but faith is tough. It's not easy. You have to struggle with it. And the reason it's worth struggling with, I think Mormonism is worth struggling with, is this idea that everybody in the world is your brother and sister, and everybody in the world is divine. And even if there is no afterlife, I would rather go to my death believing that than go to my death believing that I'm in competition with all you other bastards.
The great thing about Sunstone for me, and this is very selfish, is that I get to present papers with things that I'm struggling with personally. And in the process of writing the paper or having a dialogue with somebody, I get my ideas beat up. I have to rethink. I have to rethink. I did some good beating. Good, yes. And I have to rethink the way in which I view things. And I appreciate Jim having this conversation with me for the past 6 months. And I certainly have some different views about this than I did 6 months ago. So
let's give our panelists a hand. Okay, we got about eight minutes or so. So we'd like to invite any of you who have questions or thoughts. It's going to seem a little bit weird, but this microphone's the best. So let's have the questions and the answers come from this microphone, please.
All right, I'm one of those who raised my hand on the number one option about belief in God, but I suspect that I may have been doing exactly the same thing that you're concerned about with the bishop, and that is you were probably asking a question about a particular understanding of God, whereas I was probably responding with a very different one. So in my experience with Temple Recommend interviews, I have been able to, during the interview, talk about my different understanding of God with the person that is interviewing me. Is that an option for you, and would that resolve this issue?
No. I spoke with a friend today who told me that in his bishop's interview, the advantage I have is that I'm active and I participate fully within my ward. I sing in the war choir. I work with the 11-year-olds. These guys know me. I'm out there, and no one can miss this. One of the things he said is that he actually says no to several of the questions. And he still gets his recommend. And he says instead of it being a 4-minute interview, it is a 15-minute interview. But he's not unloading on the interviewer. He's just saying I don't know how he says it, but there are not exactly yes questions. And somehow, I guess, and he says his only guess is that they either got six more guys to get through in the next half an hour, and so they just want to get out of there, or they just go, oh, it's just Sterling, or the guy's name.
No,
Tom told me I could participate if I wanted to a little bit. I counsel three people a week on this topic. I have a good friend of mine who felt like it was his moral obligation to go into the bishop and say, I don't believe in God, I don't believe in Jesus, I think the church is fraud, and I want to baptize my daughter. And the bishop said, you know, no. But he was heartbroken because then he was feeling just so zealous in the moment. He was just feeling like, I'm a crusader for truth and justice and integrity. And then he had to go back and look his daughter in the eye and sort of say, I'm not so sure Daddy can do that, sweetie. And then I started saying, you know, I won't say his name. Sterling. You know, what are you fighting here? What battle are you fighting here? And if you win, who's going to notice? You know? And is what you're fighting for really going to give you the end goal that you're hoping for? You know, more happiness and fulfillment and truth for your family. And so I guess what I'm saying at is, I'm not saying lie, but I'm saying that be careful, be cautious. Because if you are casual with the wrong ecclesiastical leader and provide too much information, you will seal your fate in terms of what you're able to accomplish. And so I'm not saying lie, I'm not saying deceive, but I'm saying be careful. Think through whether you're comfortable with your answers and with God, so that if you can feel comfortable, try and prevent the risk that might follow under other circumstances. It's just a thought, but go ahead. I know you want to take my head off on that.
So. No. No comment.
Tom, you talked about this culture. I know. You talked about this culture of deception in Mormonism, and I actually gave a paper on this last year. But sometimes it's too narrow. Human beings in general have a culture of lying. We feel everyone in this room feels justified about lying about something, whether it be to save someone's life, to save your wife's feelings, telling her dress looks nice even if it don't, the dinner tastes good even if it didn't. But almost I don't know anyone who's never called in sick to work when they weren't really sick. If you told your kids that there was a Santa or an Easter, you deceived them, you lied to them. So I think it's a much larger thing than just the Mormon culture justifies deception. I think it's in humans in general, we're liars. That's just how it is.
I know you addressed that to Tom, but I'm going to answer. Philosophically, I'm what you call a personalist. That means that the most important philosophical category is that of the person. It's kind of like, you know, this is my work and my glory to bring to pass the immortality and eternal life of man. Now, this is a dangerous position because we can slip into what Tom was talking about lying. But, yeah, your primary, the reason Kant is wrong, you know, never lie, even if you have Jews in the back of your truck and the Nazi guy is telling, what do you got in the truck? You should say watermelons. Because the most important thing are the people. You know, you don't lie for yourself. And I know that that can open a bucket of worms, because I think some of our leaders have said that to themselves and deceived themselves. And I'm sure I do it all the time. But that's what we struggle with, and I think you're right. Yeah, the good of the person has to be the paramount concern.
Well, I had three things, but one was the Holocaust example, and that was for your benefit. Tom, just that idea of a kind of a hierarchy maybe, of commandments in some cases, or maybe like you said, who are you lying for? The liar, you know. Jim, pleasure of having dinner with you last night, and so some of these ideas came up. But then, as now, I couldn't help thinking, maybe as Tom has, that you remind me of Bill Clinton a bit. Have you ever had sex with that woman? No. okay. Sexual? Have you ever had sexual relations with that woman? Maybe this is for you, John, and I'm not sure I understood the story about your Sterling, but I would really consider it a noble thing for a man, or if you were in my session, a woman maybe, to be able to say, I'm an active member of the church. There's things I doubt about it, really fundamental things. So I don't think I can answer yes to I can't answer appropriately to the temple recommend questions, and therefore I'm going to allow my brother or my aunt or whoever to baptize my daughter. Those are the kind of people I admire, among others. But that's really an admirable thing in my mind for someone to say that. That's ethical behavior to me.
For me, one of the things I like about a priesthood is that I feel that priesthood is an opportunity to take on a role that I don't normally get to do, and that is to be a nurturer. When I lay my hands on my sons and daughters' heads and bless them, this is an opportunity for me to have a very intimate and nurturing moment that I may not have otherwise. It's an opportunity for me to take on the feminine. And it as an active Latter-day Saint, if you remember, this session isn't about inactivity or and such. I'm an active Latter-day Saint. I may be a doubter. I may be an agnostic. But I'm an active Latter-day Saint. And this is a family activity. We're going to be Latter-day Saints together. And if we can't be Latter-day Saints together in spite of my doubts, then there's a problem here. And that's why my father-in-law said, when we talked to him about him, he said, Tom, you should go fight for it. You should fight for your right to do this. And I think that someone who is being told that they shouldn't do this because of some doubt, they should go and fight for the right to have this intimate, feminine, nurturing moment from a father to a child.
But using that argument, why would you even have to be active? Why would you even need to be LDS yourself in that case? I mean, if you want to be nurturing, if you want to have it be a family activity.
Because they come from a male-dominant society where I'm not taught to nurture, and I'm not, you know, as a Latter-day Saint, we have these roles within my community. And, you know, let's face it, I was raised to be a misogynist. You know, and this is one of the opportunities in which I get to shake that off. I'm sorry, for me anyway. That it is for me.
Right. Just really quick on the Bill Clinton. I just have to. I really believe that what I said was the minimum. I don't doubt that. I don't think it conflicts with what I take to be the maximum, which is the Mormon story that I also believe in. But until such a time as I have an angel or some kind of experience come down and tell me that all those things are true, I think it's a matter of honesty to say that I believe in the minimum and I hope for the maximum. Okay.
I don't know that I have an answer.
This is for you, Brother John. I have a problem with your suggestion that there is a latitude consciously designed into the temple questions. The word testimony in our culture is a loaded word, and everyone knows what it means. It implies knowledge, not hope, not belief. So when you are answering a question, do you have a testimony, a firm testimony of the restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ, you are being corralled. I don't see latitude there. They're not saying, do you believe? do you hope for? The word testimony means something very specific in Mormon culture.
I respect and I understand that point of view, but I believe that if you ask the 15 apostles or members of the first presidency, you would get latitude. If you're talking to them one-on-one, you would get latitude between various members as to what was acceptable. And so I just choose to not be held captive or into tyranny by the most strident or orthodox of those. And I choose to invoke Hubie Brown as one who held that office just like the rest of these men now do, and say that Brother Hubie Brown or David O. McKay or Widstow or Talmadge or Eyring, those guys can define testimony just as much as the current ones can for those who may not agree. So that's just my quick answer. But let's Camille, this will be the last question, and then I have a final comment.
My grandfather said, and it's always been so wonderful for me, that gospel embraces all truth. So if it's not true, you don't have to believe it. And that's been very useful to me. And in temple recommends or other discussions with my ecclesiastical leaders, I've often said, you know, I really don't understand the temple ceremony. And I remember this one bishop saying, oh, nobody does. And I'm just wondering, I think the most important truth and person that you must be true to is yourself. And then I think you can work in the with the rest of it.
Yes, ma'am. Okay, excuse me. One comment on both the last comments. Countless times in my life, I've had to redefine what all these terms mean. The restoration, the first vision, on and on and on and on. I have decided that I believe in them, but I will probably keep redefining them for the rest of my life until I come into the presence of God. And, you know, it's like when I was a kid and they were telling me I couldn't believe in evolution. I remember I saying to him, oh, I'll go on believing it, and when God tells me he did it some other way, then I'll believe that. So we don't have to believe what isn't true. Just wait and see.
There's a second part to that story about my friend. The conversation we had a few months ago, Surly, the conversation we had a few months ago was after the bishop had told him no. And so I spent an hour in the middle of my workday one time outside of a pizza joint saying, Christopher, go back into your bishop. Oh, my gosh, I did it too. I said, I actually don't think he'd mind. I said, Christopher, go back into your bishop and say, Bishop, I've really been struggling. And when I came to you the last time, there were some books I was reading and there's some things I was feeling. And yeah, I was a bit angry. But the truth is, what I told you back then doesn't fully represent how I'm feeling. I'm open to there being a God. I'm open to the resurrection and the atonement. And I'm open to Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon being inspired. But the truth is, I don't fully, you know, the way that I would define that and understand it probably isn't the same way you would. But I'm here. I'm willing to hold a calling. I'm willing to be active. I'm willing to raise my family in this church. But I just can't say that my beliefs probably are similar to yours. I'm happy to tell you that he did go back to the bishop. He had that conversation. And 2 weeks ago, he was able to baptize his daughter. For him, I think he said that night after he did it, he felt a combination of joy and sadness. He had his father do the confirmation, because he felt more comfortable doing the baptism but didn't feel like the confirmation was something he could do. So he had his father do the confirmation. And then he said he went back to work the next Monday and he grabbed his Richard Dawkins book and he opened it up and he got all sorts of, you know, joy and reveling in that as a contrast to what he's been struggling with. So I don't know what the answer is, but all I can say is let's not get wrapped up and tied down by the tyranny of or. that it's got to be true or false. Let's not allow them to impose that upon us. This is going to be a journey. The most faithful person can become a doubter, and I've seen so many people who've left the church wander their way back in. And so this is an evolution. This is a journey. And we just want to thank Tom and Jim and all of you for helping us be a part of it. So, thank you.